Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
The Fiery Wings of Sleeping Birds by Julie Carpenter, read by Dan Luscombe, with music by the author.
The Fiery Wings of Sleeping Birds by Julie Carpenter. The wave of revulsion hit so hard that time stood still. The food on her tongue turned to ash, the breath in her lungs hot misery. Sydney's hand, poised mid-scoop over the cereal bowl, contracted into a helpless claw as the spoon clattered to the floor. Just when the weight of the air became intolerable and threatened to suffocate her, the world resumed speed and the sensations fled. She caught her wife's startled expression across the breakfast table and tried to signal that everything was fine, but instead slid helplessly out of her chair as her consciousness failed. She awoke to Freya's moon-shaped face hovering placidly above, a perfect satellite of concern. "Sid, how many times is this now?"
"I don't know. 5, 6? How long was I out?"
Freya sat down on the floor next to their overstuffed couch where she had arranged Sid's thin body in a nest of pillows. "Long enough. Let's get you to Dr. Peterson for a scan. You can ride with me. I need to go into the lab and check on the latest implants anyway." Weighing a protest, Sid finally shrugged and agreed to go. It had happened 10 times now, each time harder to shake. Dr. Peterson's neuroimaging lab was on the floor just above Freya's department. Officially, she was head of the Avian Comparative Molecular Neuroscience Laboratory, but the researchers just called it Raven Lab. She parted from Sid in the elevator and went to see the results of the latest experiments. When aliens first made contact 50 years ago, it became apparent that while the two species could communicate very simple concepts through great effort, any meaningful technical exchange was impossible. The underlying logic of the alien language was the outcome of their unique evolution, which, while convergent with Homo sapiens in many useful ways, was unimaginably divergent in others. For instance, in half a century of study, it was still not apparent what the aliens called themselves. Their movements and motivations remained as inscrutable as the ancient gods of myth. They came and went from a half a dozen landing sites around the world. Neither aggressive nor benevolent, they left an area when attacked and never returned to it. When approached, they allowed humans to examine them, but often would suddenly terminate the exchange in a flurry of limbs and a torrent of otherworldly sound. Whether it was a language, a song, or a warning was unclear. What was clear was that their technology was so advanced as to appear magical, and facing an accelerating global ecological collapse, the human race desperately needed some magic. A cacophony of croaks, clicks, and caws greeted Freya as the lab door slid open. Ravens had been chosen early on as study animals because of their unique intelligence and linguistic abilities. 10 birds comprised the latest cohort. Freya and her colleagues had painstakingly rewired tiny regions of the ravens' brains to mimic patterns of neurons in the aliens' cognitive organs. Not the grand pattern, of course. That was the madness that Sid and Dr. Peterson pursued upstairs. Freya took a more basic approach. She hoped that by studying the leaf, she could understand the tree. She donned a pair of gloves and opened a cage door, gently removing a glossy black dead bird. Its back was broken, snapped as if a massive seizure had stiffened every muscle. For now, the other bird survived, but it was likely only a matter of time before the same incompatible code killed them. It made sense. The aliens could break and reform their unusual skeletal structures easily, so movement at the expense of bone was not inhibited. This raven had broken his back by stretching his muscles past the breaking point of his spine. This group of birds was the 10th generation of birds bred from the most promising early alien to avian implant subjects. In other trials, some birds had drowned in air
when they forgot how to breathe. Others refused to eat and starved unless force-fed. The successful subjects could be roughly divided into dancers, speakers, and sleepers. The dancers adopted erratic, stylized movements, an odd spatial orientation, often hanging upside down. Speakers chattered away in what sounded like the alien speech, but without syntax, much like a human baby babbles phonemes while learning their parent language. Sleepers, well, they slept. They took food if offered, but remained permanently asleep in one hemisphere of their brains, according to scans. Some neural implants led to birds that fit the categories neatly, while other combinations led to birds with a mixture of these traits. One nerve cluster at a time, Freya was identifying which patterns could be assimilated by terrestrial organisms, and which were so foreign to life here as to be fatal. Freya took a seat at her computer to share the results with her team. On the floor above, Cid awaited the results of her scan. After removing the Medusa's tangle of electrodes from Cid's shaved head, the doctor took only a few moments to deliver the verdict. Incompatible. The alien neural clusters are threatening her basic brain functions, said Dr. Peterson, glancing away from Cid trembling on the edge of the cot and towards his three young interns and the glowering military liaison. He turned back to Cid and added gently, "But we knew that, didn't we?" Her elfin chin dropped slightly. It wasn't fair. She'd come so far and they were tantalizingly close to a breakthrough. Cid was both an exobiologist and an epileptic, a unique candidate for Peterson's program. As a child, her brain had been surgically divided to ease the electrical storms that crippled her. Now, like one of Freya's birds, she had received grafts of the alien brain patterns. But unlike the ravens, her divided mind kept her human self safe in her left lobe, while they slowly implanted the alien operating system on the right. Gradually, through drawings, dreams, and hypnotic sessions, precious fragments of alien intelligence began to filter out through Cid. She felt so close to understanding something fundamental about them, but it eluded her, and apparently would elude her forever, as the alien patterns were now jumping the gap and wreaking havoc. At any moment, they could unseat her mind and leave her a vacant shell. That, or her heart could beat so fast that it exploded, or so slowly that she could simply slip away. She was less afraid of death and more angry at her helplessness. Perhaps it was a symptom and not an inspiration, but Cid desperately wished to continue. She decided to ask to test one last hypothesis. Peterson ran his hand over his own scarred, bald forehead and agreed that, given the situation, the risk was acceptable. The bell at the lab door startled Freya out of her work. Peterson's intern Michael was standing outside, looking like he'd been sent to his execution. She buzzed him in and he handed her a folded paper. Her world teetered a bit on its axis as she read, "My dearest Freya, by the time you read this, I will be asleep. In my dreams, the lucid dreams like we practiced, I will be able to find out who they are, why they're here, and what they have that could save us, and how to ask them for it. I've told the doctor to graft to me everything we have, but if I was awake, it would destroy me. So he must induce sleep and dream state. Do you remember when we met? You said, we have no gifts from the gods, only the gifts that we give each other. Well, my gifts to this world are these scars in my head. I hope that your gift will be to find a way to heal them and wake me up safely. It's like when I got stuck in the mud driving into town during the floods and you were so furious, but you came to save me anyway. You said then that your birds were smarter than me. It's true. At least they didn't volunteer for this. I've asked Peterson to turn over all of his data to you and to make you a full partner in the project. I'm sorry, there was no time, and if I saw you again, I never could have done it. I'm sorry I didn't tell you how far we had gone. Please wake me up soon so I can grow my hair out long again, like when we were young. Your foolish bird, Cid."
A drop in the ocean, by Keith Howington, read by Jean-Paul Garnier, music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. A drop in the ocean. You moved carefully over the ice, occasionally slipping on the crystals frozen out of the methane-rich atmosphere of this world. Each time he slipped, a hand felt reflexively for the two flat objects in their padded pouch at his side. They were not fragile, in the normal sense, and could withstand a modest amount of impact without damage, but they represented great value and a large investment of time, even if it wasn't exactly his time. The scientist knew he probably didn't have much time. The theft had been discovered, and he had been followed even to this out-of-the-way place. Lon's lightweight environmental suit was reasonably comfortable for the moment, and the distance to the refueling ship was not far. And that ship gave him just the opening, literally, that he needed. Once he got there, well, his plans weren't quite developed that far yet. Lon slipped again and cursed eloquently the evolutionary heritage that repurposed front legs for tool use, leaving him too few to be stable on this treacherous plane. His suit communicator sprang to life, startling him badly. Three legs slid out from under him, and he went down on the one remaining knee. Lon, Gavin, you are ordered to remain where you are. Lon instinctively ducked, but made no reply. Maybe they thought he was waiting for them. He'd bolted from his landing craft when he received the first communication demanding his surrender. His suit's equipment told him direction, oriented to this world's relatively feeble magnetic field, but he had not thought to bring a direction finder. With any luck, he was more than halfway to the ship. He forced himself to think about something less fearful than the coming confrontation. The ice commanded much of his attention, gray-brown, stained from contact with this murky atmosphere which was poisonous to breathe, and even poisonous to the life below the ice. With so much energy from the local star reflected back into space, this ice had probably not changed much in the planet's nearly 4 billion year history. Certainly, the life below the ice was primitive, seemingly locked in a stalemate with the environment. It was simple, individual life units. No cooperation, no specialization. Nothing had ever been found in this planet's oceans that would qualify as a multi-celled organism. Lon's own research had been on the life of this refueling station. He became part of the team developing technology based on it, since there was something to learn even from primitive life forms. The local life used a genetic encoding different from anything seen before, but that was fairly easy to manipulate. Lon, too, had been fairly easy to manipulate. Was he duped into stealing two of the research containers, or was he too willing to be paid off to make up for his own efforts being downplayed? He didn't know, and he thought about it since he first left his homeworld. Ah, but that payoff didn't happen, and he'd wound up here, on the world the research was based on, running for his life. Jarni moved carefully on the slick surface, tracking his prey across this strange world. The Golden Star's fuel bunker rested just ahead, and Lon was going to beat him to it. He could not see Lon, though in clearer air he would have been visible in the distance. Perhaps a distraction. Lon, I see you. What do you think you can do with that bunker? Jarni watched his screen carefully. Yes, Lon had stopped moving. Good. But there was no answer. Then, don't come any closer. Jarni was amused. Now, why would you say that? You know it's my job to take you back with me. I tell you again, come no closer. Lon sounded pathetic, even to himself, but he took hope from one aspect. His pursuer's comment made it seem that he was near his destination. Lon peered into the distance, but the clouds of cold particulates deafened his infrared vision. He used the suit's eyepieces, which shifted light down from a slightly higher spectrum. There was something. Perhaps the heat beacon of the fueling craft seemed to give off waste light in a higher range, for he saw a couple of dim points of illumination shining like stars in the murk. He lurched back to his feet and paced toward the light, hand clasped on the pouch just above his front left leg. Walking was tricky enough here, but looking through the eyepieces to do so made the going difficult. He realized that the light was growing rapidly brighter, a and now could use his vision just moments to go, and he would think of something. Jarni, too, was hampered by vision limitations. He followed the rogue scientist's telltale across the surface, but was having to proceed slowly. Frustrating. This top slush was slippery indeed, though it looked roughened to the naked eye. He was so intent on his instruments that he was surprised by the beacon from the bunker ship. Now, though, he could focus on his footing and maybe gain some time. The ship materialized from the mist. Lon had never seen a fueling operation, despite how common the practice was on this planet. His research stations were small and self-contained. He seemed to be close, but he struggled to adjust for the scale of the thing. Lon Gven, stop. I see you now. Lon, this time, was too focused on his goal, and he found as he approached that the footing was better. Apparently, the operation of punching through ice under the ship affected the ice nearby. He ran. Jarni could make out, barely, Lon's form breaking into a run. He automatically did the same, and both front legs went sideways on the first step. Jarni instinctively rolled right to shield his weapon from impact, but this didn't protect his leg, and he felt the right forward give as too much strain was applied. The communication link was still open, and he managed to do no more than grunt as he held the injured limb to his belly. But training won out, and grunting again, he got on his remaining legs and staggered forward across the ice. Momentarily, the going got easier, though he still could not put weight on that foreleg. The bulk of the fueler, essentially a giant water tank with accessories, loomed over Lon. He ran underneath the belly of the beast and found the main intake pipe. It was several times his own length across. In a happier time, he would have been distracted calculating the rates of flow and just how long it took to pump enough reaction mass for the mighty vessel in orbit overhead. For now, he keenly wanted to see how it penetrated the ice. Yes, there was a low area around the pipe's base, now that he was close enough to see into it, and at the edge of the pipe itself, at the bottom of the surrounding slope, was what he'd hoped for. Stop where you are! But Lon was ready. Jarni's query did not stop, and reached into a pouch. Jarni half expected a weapon, though it would have to be small. But no, as Jarni limped closer, he could make out that Leon was holding aloft the stolen goods, the science containers he'd stolen. That was a foolish mistake. Lon, set it down and step aside, and lay down with limbs out. You stop. You know what I've got. Actually, I don't, nor do I care. I will bring you back and your stolen goods, too. Your choice now is simple. Do you want to be alive for the trip? You don't know what this is. Lon held his hand up higher. This is the fate of the world, and you cannot... The shot pierced Lon, cutting off his speech and hurling him backward. Jarni had aimed low, through Lon's heart chambers and well away from the hand holding the package. An easy shot at this range, and the stopping power of his military-issued projectile weapon made this stop permanent. Jarni's job was now to recover the stolen goods, intact, and he'd been told that a simple drop to the ground would not harm the container or contents. But to Jarni's annoyance, Lon's body went backwards, and apparently into some low depression around the pipe behind him. The dropped package went over with him, slung backward by the impact to its holder. Blast! Jarni rushed forward, stopping at the edge of a formed crater. He watched, fascinated, as Lon's body slid down the gentle slope away from him. Yes, there was the package. And then Jarni looked past the sliding body to the area around the pipe. Open water. He launched over the edge himself, and immediately decided that this wasn't a good idea. He had no line, no way to fasten himself to anything, nothing to stop his slide, and he hadn't seen any of the ship's crew out. They had more sense than he was exhibiting. All right. One thing at a time, grab the goods, and the body if convenient, and, somehow, stop. The maddening package was too smooth, and kept right behind its erstwhile thief, bumping into the body as it slid over the slightly irregular surface. Jarni, sprawled, but struggling to go faster, caught up to his goal just as it slid over the edge. One hand on the package, one on his victim, and immediately letting go of both when his injured leg hit a protrusion of ice at the edge. Shooter, target, and the package that did not contain the fate of the planet disappeared under the narrow liquid surface around the pipe. All immediately sank, with Jarny still clutching his leg. Jarny's next action was to curse himself and swim awkwardly forward to grab the body in the fading illumination. He thought that the biggest problem was the missing package, now a dark rectangle dropping invisibly into the depths below. Jarny's life support system kept him alive for quite some time. He had time to search the body still in his grip, looking for something useful, and only then discovered that the second package was still in Lon's hip pouch, pierced by Jarny's projectile. The teeny robot, one of trillions once contained in the stasis package, moved carefully across the surface. It had been engineered to modify the basic codes of certain cells, to install a gene suppression mechanism for the development cycle, to allow cooperation, specialization, and with any luck, to kickstart the development of multicellular creatures. The creature moved carefully across the surface, leaving tracks in the soft mud of the sea bottom. Its body was simple, and it had uncountable cousins, most of which did not survive the trial and error of different body plans. For tens of millions of years, the new concept, multicellular life, would be an upstart competitor to the bacteria and single cells that had reigned supreme for uncounted millions of years. But by the end of this period, the Cambrian explosion would have resulted in a few basic, successful multicellular plants, and the world would never be the same. In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard The Fiery Wings of Sleeping Birds by Julie Carpenter, with music by the author. A Drop in the Ocean by Keith Howington, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Out now, Simultaneous Times, Volume 1, Science Fiction Paperback Anthology. Available at spacecowboybooks.com. Also, be sure to connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Let us know what you thought of the episode.